Council, we're ready to hear from you. Case is number 183054, Foxfield Villa Associates versus Robin.
Good morning, Your Honor, and may it please the court. John Duggan on behalf of the appellants, Foxfield Villa Associates, LLC, and the related parties. Under the U.S. Supreme Court decision in Howey, we're here today to decide under the third prong of that test whether or not this particular investment was one where Paul Robin, quote, led the investors to expect profits from him, the promoter, or a third party.
Could Robin have vetoed the action by the FBA?
Pardon?
Could Robin have vetoed the action by the FBA?
I don't understand. The action to bring the suit?
Yes. No, any administrative action.
So FBA can only act through those persons, human beings, that are authorized to act.
Right.
The operating agreement said majority of the unit interest. Robin, because of his embedded control of a 50% owner,
right,
as a result, could veto any proposed action.
So the answer to my question is yes.
Yes.
Thank you.
And so back to my point, in this case, mm-hmm, I think the analysis is rather straightforward and simple, largely because of Paul Robin's admissions. This case is very much different than a number of the other reported cases that you see circulating around. First, Paul Robin admitted unequivocally in his testimony and in his summary judgment papers that he agreed that he led the investors that invested money in this transaction that they would derive profits solely from his efforts on two important counts. One, that Paul Robin would buy the 38 multifamily lots for $1.6 million, which he exclusively controlled. And number two, that Paul Robin would manage the construction, marketing, and sale of the lots to be developed on the 9.1 acres, keeping in mind that he had an 8-year institutional understanding of this master plan project. It wasn't just these two components. It was a 240-acre development, of which the 38 multifamily lots and the 9.1 acres were two separate small components of that larger development. Paul Robin admitted, and it's in the appendix at page A2610 and A3153 through 3157, the summary judgment papers, he admitted, no one would have invested any money in this transaction had I not agreed with my institutional experience to continue running the project because I had all the knowledge of all the complexities, and B, I would buy the lots.
All right. Could the plaintiffs have exerted control then over the FBA as well? Not did they, but could they?
Not without Paul Robin's consent. Paul Robin, by virtue of controlling a 50% member, could veto any action proposed by any other party.
And veto, right?
Veto. Keep in mind, when the transaction closed, Judge Lucero, when the transaction closed, Paul Robin secured two resolutions. One banking resolution that said he would have all authority for all banking transactions, and that banking transaction, which is part of the record on its terms, says he will continue to do so until it is revoked.
Did all the members agree to that resolution?
Yes, they all did. Okay. At the outset. And the second...
All right, so that's a little hard to rely on, isn't it, if one of your clients agreed to that resolution?
No,
I mean, one of your clients was a full 50% owner.
Correct.
And so, I mean, there was no opposition to him having this control.
None whatsoever. He represented that he would run the project in its entirety. He would exclusively manage it. We believed him. We agreed with him. We put him in that position, and we signed resolutions so stating.
Right.
In addition to that, Paul Robinson.
I mean, but your client could have, at the time of the banking resolution, said, you know, I'm just not comfortable with you having a blank check. I'd rather have some authority over the bank account as well.
Well, so for purposes of this, again...
I mean, they could have raised that.
They could have.
Okay.
Of course they could have. There's nobody that disputes that,
right,
Judge Carson. Of course they could. And I understand that point. The point being is that goes to, under this entire analysis, everybody's intent that he would exclusively manage. In fact, he got a second resolution that authorized Paul Robin to take all actions on behalf of the entity, to sign all contracts that he deemed appropriate to be signed.
Where is that in the record?
It's part of a record, judge, in the trial court down below, and I don't know that it is part of this record, but it's part of the testimony.
Part of this record, we're not going to consider it. Why didn't you make it part of our record?
Well,
if that's so important.
It was marked as a trial exhibit for the upcoming trial that never occurred because summary judgment was granted.
We have to decide. I've looked everywhere for something like that, and it's not in the appellate record.
And Judge will probably request the court take judicial notice. It's part of a trial record in a state court proceeding that's undisputed that Paul Robin testified to.
Not even in this court proceeding.
Understood. I understand that. So where I get back to is Paul Robin under the documents.
That's a serious error on your part.
Well,
and I'm not sure what we're going to do about it, but I looked everywhere to see what happens because it looked like, this is not probably the right term to use these days, but it looked like this FVA was set up for gridlock because Mr. Robin had a veto over everything, and yet the documents seem to say that the board controls everything from who, what attorney you hire, you know, all sorts of things. And so I'm wondering, how did this thing get run? And I couldn't find anything in the record, and you're telling me it's in a trial court record in a different jurisdiction.
And Paul Robin admitted, Judge Hartz, that in fact he knew he had the authority to run everything, and we provided this court of this record all the contracts that he signed with the vendors. The banking resolution is part of the record that you've been supplied with. He was the only person that had the authority to take action and transfer the money on the banking resolutions. Paul Robin signed all the agreements with the vendors to spend millions of dollars to build the project. And Paul Robin admitted in his deposition, as the president of the company, I'd been authorized by the other members to go forward and run this exclusively. There's no fact dispute that Paul Robin admits he had the authority and was granted the authority.
Well, and so let me get into the timing of this. Because the documents creating FVA provide for the board to have a lot of these powers, but acting only through a majority, it's clear that there wouldn't be a majority of FVA interests absent Robin's consent. So were these documents giving him this additional authority, was that executed at the time FVA was created, or at what point afterwards?
Yes, the documents that I'm speaking of, Paul Robin presented a package to the investors, including the banking resolution, the operating agreement, everything that was signed at closing. And Paul Robin,
when you say at closing,
they bought a real estate transaction, and their investment was to fund the real estate transaction coupled with some bank loans. So their money went into the company that bought the real estate.
But when was that in relation to the documents, the signing of the documents creating FVA?
They were all signed on March 24, 2008.
All this stuff was
everything was in
so
one
the
bundle.
The investment and the granting of this additional authority to Robin was at the same time that the operating document, that the organizational documents for FVA were
March 24, 2008. Well, title company.
You could have saved a lot of trouble if you had that in the record. I'm not sure what we're going to do about that.
Well, so the point being here is, Judge, that Paul Robin, whether you want to look at the resolution in the state court trial, which you're suggesting you don't want to, he testified in his deposition, I have the authority. I
is
did
that
everything.
In our appellate record?
Yes, it is. It's part of what we submitted to Judge Murguia down below.
Well, is it in the record before this court?
Yes, it is. We've cited to it in our factual assertions. Paul Robin
and he testified. Describes these documents that were signed.
He describes the fact that he signed the construction contracts to build it, the banking resolution, and that he knew as the president of the company that he had all authority to take all actions on behalf of the entity. Nobody's disputed that ever in this case. Nobody's ever suggested that Paul Robin didn't, because if they he'd have perjured himself.
I thought the judge had some concerns about that, but go ahead.
He did, but he ignored the record citations that we supplied to him, including the copies of Paul Robin's deposition transcript, where he said it unequivocally. But that's only under the Williamson Factor 1, what are the corporate governance documents? In this court, Merchant Capital, even in the Howey case, the court said, we're not just going to look at the general partnership agreement or the operating agreement. We're going to look at the totality of the documents. And the 11th Circuit in Merchant Capital and...
Well, wait. When you look, the important part is not actual control, but the right to control. And that's what's in the document that you did not provide us.
No, it's in the banking resolution, and it's in Paul Ryden's testimony. And the courts...
How much authority does the banking resolution give?
Gives him authority to engage in all the banking actions. And quite frankly, there's four reported decisions directly on point that say if the promoter has control of the bank accounts, Merchant Capital, the 11th Circuit, and Albanese v. Florida National Bank, 823 Fed 2nd, 408, to Eastern, that case is not. That's a case that is cited in Merchant Capital, and it's actually cited by a number of other cases. Cases have followed that lead and said when a banking resolution provides the promoter with the exclusive authority over the banking accounts, that is a de facto control that substantiates the Williamson Factor 1 under the corporate governance documents.
That's nice, but what authority for that is in your brief?
We've argued that in this brief.
What cases have authorized?
Shields, Merchant Capital, Howey.
Those are cited in your... Well, Howey says that?
Yes, Howey's got four different contracts the U.S. Supreme Court looked at to determine whether or not there was an investment contract. They didn't look at a single document. And my point is, we win on Williamson 1, but we win on Williamson 3. There's never been a case, a record presented to a court of appeals, it's in a reported case, where Paul Ryden made the admissions he made here to substantiate his indispensability and the fact that he led the investors to expect profits from him and third parties.
Let me ask you a couple of questions. How easily were the interests in this LLC transferable? Were there restrictions on transfer of the interests?
Yes, like a lot of closely held companies, the company could buy it first, and then they had to approve it, and if you sold it without getting the approval, the party became an assignee to the economic interest but didn't have any voting rights.
Right, okay. And does that sort of weigh against it being a security? I'm not asking you to concede your case. I just wanted to talk frankly about some of the things in the case.
No, so we have cases, and there's a lot of these partnership cases, the Sixth Circuit in Coke, this case in Shields, where there was an impracticability of transferring these interests because there's no market for them. And they had
that's different.
Well, I understand that, but they had transfer restrictions. And so the fact that there are restrictions on transfer, there's no case out there that says that constitutes a hurdle to bring in a securities law claim.
Right.
It just doesn't exist.
It concerns me in this case that it appears that the intent of the parties here was not to be, you know, creating a security under the securities laws, that it was not widely offered. These were people who had worked together closely in the past. So there you've got a very narrow offering of people who claim to be friends. You have restrictions on alienability of the interests, so it suggests maybe there was no intent to be marketing these interests.
I understand the concerns, and I do have a point to make, and I think it will sharpen the point, Judge Carson.
All right.
The U.S. Supreme Court in Landreth, there was one investor, bought all the securities. It wasn't offered to the public, and the U.S. Supreme Court 1985 decision said that's a security under the Securities Act. The statute doesn't provide any limitations on numbers of people that have to be investors or whether there's restrictions on transferability.
Now, there are some cases, though, that have considered those factors. Don't you agree with that?
Yes, and so what happens is the courts look to, under Williamson 2, they look at, well, how many people were there and were they geographically dispersed? And my view is this. That's not a hurdle to bring in a securities law claim. It's simply a factor to be considered under Williamson 2, i.e., did they have the practical capacity to enforce their rights? And the courts have gone to that and said, we find a security largely because they're geographically dispersed and they don't know each other, so they probably aren't going to be able to get together to form the vote of 51% to get rid of somebody. But those cases don't ever say or even imply that there is a minimum number of investors that have to be present to bring a case or that restriction transfer requirements would bar a security finding.
Right. So one more thing. Your clients were officers, and one of them was the vice president. And I was just looking in the record, and apparently the vice president performed the president's duties when the president refused to act.
Correct.
And it seemed like the operating agreement gave control over what the president's duty was to carry out the wish of the members. of which your clients were members. And so, I mean, isn't there an argument that your one of your clients as the vice president could have said, hey, you're not carrying out your duties, and I'm stepping in to make some of these decisions?
I have 3 seconds. May I respond to that question?
Please,
thank you so much.
Thank you for asking.
You're welcome. Judge Carson, I understand the argument. In fact, my good friend Mr. Pitkin has made that argument in sorts. And I would suggest no, because that still requires Paul Robin to consent to say, I'm refusing to act as president, which he never did.
Well, I don't think he has to consent he's refusing to act. I mean, you might have to get an independent determination that he's refusing to act.
Again, and where you get back to is when there's a resolution that says he's authorized to act, we told him he could act, we acquiesced in his actions. It'd be very difficult for us to go to court and say, oops, all those agreements we signed that gave him all this authority, he's now saying, I'm going to act, but we're going to jump in and jump ahead of him. I don't think there's a court in Johnson County that would have affirmed that in Kansas.
Interesting point. I hadn't thought about that. Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. And I wasn't presumptive enough to ask for any rebuttal because I didn't think I'd have it.
Well, some advocates just help themselves.
And that may be the first time.
As you observed this morning.
That may be the first time with Mr. Duggan that I will get the last word. May it please the court, my name is Robert Pitkin. I represent the defendants who are the appellees in this case. I think that the court is obviously well aware.
We've all been candid with you all this time.
Judge Lucero, you're probably maybe the most experienced on this. You've had the Shields case and the Shaden case, so you've grappled with this issue before. And
let me say this. I had observed from the briefs, or discerned from the briefs, better said, that the plaintiffs here at the time of the investment, not what happened after the investment, but at the time of the investment, had the power to actually control the FVA. I am told by your adversary that's not correct. Would you give me your view of that, please?
Sure. And I was not, I think it's also clear from the record that me and my client did testify in the underlying case. That was years before my involvement, but I didn't have any involvement in that case. And so I've dealt with this case, which started in 2015, at least my involvement in it, when the Second Amendment complaint was filed. And I would say...
Why is that relevant?
Oh, he was referencing something from the other case, is my point. And
okay.
I'm just not as familiar with that record.
I got you. The one that's not before us.
Correct. My recollection from the discovery in this case was that the operating agreement was prepared in October of 2007, so 6 or 7 months before. It was the same time that Mr. Bartlett set up his real estate LLC that was actually the member here. So there was the pre-existing relationship between Straub and Robin on a prior project. That's one of the members. The other was Bartlett set up his own LLC in the fall of 2007. That was the same time that the operating agreement was prepared for FVA, this LLC. The operating agreement was not signed, but it was signed, I believe, well before, and I don't know if that's specifically in the record. I know I know Ernie Straub's deposition and Rick Bartlett's depositions were both in there. These banking resolutions, any other resolutions would have happened at a subsequent time. They would have probably been done at the time of closing. That would make the most sense when you bought the property, because you were buying two different pieces of property and with the loans from two different banks. And then,
so you disagree that the execution of the documents creating FVA was at the same time as the one, the banking resolution, and second, this document that's in the state court record giving Mr. Robin broad managerial powers?
That's my recollection, Judge.
They were different times.
They were different times. The operating agreement was signed when they decided to move forward, because I do know, and I believe it's in the record, that the parties contributed, including my client. I mean, this wasn't a situation, as in a lot of these cases, where my client is saying, give me your money and I'll take care of you. He put up his 25% just like everybody else. I guess Bartlett put up 50%, but he put up 25. Straub put up 25. So he had skin in this game. They made the decision to move forward. Obviously, you have to make that decision, get the loans in place, then you close at a subsequent time. And my understanding is that any other documents that were signed were signed, number one, a banking resolution because you have to say who can sign on behalf of the company so that everybody doesn't have to sign. And then the other thing was really, I think, more of an accommodation because you had one of the members who was going to sign contracts. And I can bore you with the details of this project, but it may not matter to you. But what part of the project had to be developed so they could sell it as lots. So there was some construction and improvements that had to be made. And again, as an accommodation, having one of the members with the authority to sign that, sign those documents, rather than having all of the members sign, was a matter of accommodation, I think.
What about the time of the investment? Right. Was the investment at the time of the execution of the documents creating the FEA? Was that at the time of the banking resolution? Do we know the time there?
Here's my recollection, and again, from discovery, and I believe it's in the record, is that in late February, there was a meeting at Bank of Blue Valley, and all the people were there, my client and Mr. Duggan's clients. And that was when the decision was made to move forward. The operating agreement had already been prepared. That was prepared in 2007. The money was then paid by all the parties, $100,000 per 25%, a total of $400,000. My client wrote a check for $100,000. That was all done like the second week of March. And we don't have the operating agreement, as you know, is not dated. So we do have that little bit of a hurdle. But why would
In terms of power of control at that time, what is your position with respect to the power of the plaintiffs at that point?
Well, I think
the point that you're talking about.
And you brought up a good point about the veto power. Well, Paul Robin theoretically had veto power, but so did the plaintiffs. Meaning
that's,
Paul Robin
well, that's
didn't
my
have,
question. In what manner did the plaintiffs enjoy the same veto power as Robin?
Well, it was, again, as a lawyer, I didn't draft this, but as a lawyer, I'm guessing what happened was somebody prepared this with the idea of majority in interest, super majority in interest, and those are important things for different decisions. But the way that it was set up, I think Judge Hartz mentioned it,
right,
that it was set up for potential gridlock. Now, there wasn't any gridlock. I mean, there's no evidence that they ever had gridlock. In fact, my client withdrew when he was asked to withdraw. So there wasn't any actual gridlock. I think that
presumably, or apparently I should say, is because Mr. Robin was given all this authority. Because he could sign all the documents. I mean, it makes it look like you need a board resolution before you can hire an attorney, hire an accountant, do all these things.
Well,
and I was wondering, and how in the world did they get done? Now I learned for the first time about this agreement that conveyed that authority to Mr. Robb.
Well, I mean, essentially this was a purchase of raw land, and part of the development had already been developed into lots so that they could sell it and somebody could hire their own builder, or you could have a builder program, whatever. Unfortunately, the economic crisis hit. Nothing happened. I mean, that's really what happened here. On the 40 villa lots, which is the Bank of Blue Valley loan, which was the loan that the plaintiffs sued the bank over in state court, that there had to be some improvements. But it was things that got done within 6 months. It was all done by the end of 2008. Now, unfortunately, terrible timing. You've got residential real estate that's ready to be sold the end of 2008, and we all know what happened.
Let me tell you where I'm coming from.
Yeah.
And you can try to convince me, point out to me where I'm, what I'm missing. It seems to me we really can't tell whether there's an investment contract here, and in any event, it should be the district court's decision in the first place. And the reason we can't rely on the district court's opinion at this point and why it needs to go back there is because the district court had a misconception and thought that because 75% of the economic interest was owned by the plaintiffs, that they had 75% control, which was not the fact. At best, they could, well, if there was this resolution at the outset giving Mr. Robin this various authority, there was nothing that 75% interest could do to keep him from doing anything. You cannot get a board resolution saying, no, Mr. Robin, you can't do this. So why isn't that a serious enough error by the district court that it has to be remanded for reconsideration and decide whether or not this is an investment contract?
Yeah, and I think that, number one, that's not the only basis upon which Judge Murguia made his decision.
It wasn't the only basis, but it was clearly an important component. And if you make a serious legal error in deciding something, we generally will say you need to reconsider after correcting that error.
Well, and obviously this court knows that a judgment of a district court can be affirmed for any reason. And so if there are other reasons in the record besides that, well, that support his decision.
And then you can make that argument, but I would think that it would be better for the district court to in the first instance, particularly since what we're hearing today is some factual matter that might make a difference. And it'd be nice to have that presented to the district court and let the district court weigh that. I'm not saying I don't have any strong feelings one way or another how this should come out, but it does seem like there was an error of law here, or fact, I'm not quite sure how to describe it.
Yeah.
That was central to the judge's decision, and the judge ought to reconsider.
As I read it, and as I had always approached it, because obviously I've had to live with that fact too, this was not a situation where they had a 75% block and they could outvote him 75 or 25 all the time. But there were restrictions on what the president could and could not do. This was member managed. I think that's an important fact. This is not a manager managed. They did not make him a manager of an LLC that would have inherent powers to be able to do things. This was a member managed, which means ultimately the members, the plaintiffs, had the authority
and
to decide.
And as Judge Carsten pointed out, maybe that's the essential thing, is that
right
at the outset, but it's also possible that very early in the game, maybe even before the money was invested, they gave that management power to Mr. Robin, and at that point, they couldn't overcome it because they just had 50% of the vote at board meeting.
But that was their choice, number one. And number two, I think what is important too, I asked both Mr. Schraub and Mr. Bartlett in their depositions, and they're part of the record, they were attached to the plaintiff's motion, whether or not anything that they're complaining about, any of what essentially would be their fraud claims, had anything to do with anything that happened after the closing. And they said no. It was everything before the closing.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Let me also ask you this. Is there anything in the record that tells us how the partners treated this for tax purposes? Are they all active, or are some passive?
I do know that, ironically, Mr. Straub treated it as active. I did ask him that in his deposition, and that was his tax returns were part of the record. So Mr. Straub did treat it as an active loss. Now, I'm not sure that's necessarily...
For partnership purposes, they treat...
Correct.
For tax purposes, they treated themselves as active partners.
Correct.
Not
correct.
Passive. All right.
Correct.
Thank you.
I do know that, because I actually, one of the reasons I asked that was primarily for a different reason, was to try to tie down some statute of limitations issue, but I think it has a bearing on this as well. I think some of the other things that are in the operating agreement, I've tried to point them out, that are similar to the things that you'll see in the LLC cases. And again, I will say from the LLC cases that we've cited to you, all of the LLC cases, they've all held, as they did in the Shaden case, that it's not an investment contract. That's not dispositive, because maybe there is one out there. I just don't think this is the case, because this isn't a case where a person who didn't have skin in the game raised a ton of money. This isn't a situation where he installed himself as a manager instead of just another member.
And who was the general partner?
There was no general partner.
No general partner?
Nope. There was no general partner. It was an LLC, so it essentially operated with the Bartlett group having 50% and the Prez group having 50%, and then Prez was Robin and Straub, who had done a prior project. Now, in the operating agreement, these are other things that the cases that have held that LLCs are not investment contract are important. Number one, in section 5.1 of the operating agreement, any member could call a special meeting. And courts have said that's important because you have the ability to get together, try to talk about issues, and then see if there's a refusal to act. Somebody asked about the refusal to act by the president, and then the vice president could step in.
That ability to call a meeting under Kansas law or under the operating agreement?
There is actually a statute in Kansas. I don't have it off the top of my head, but I do know that there's a statute that gives that right. It's also in section 5.1 of the operating agreement
that Thank you.
The parties signed here. Now, the other thing that I think is important, and the cases talk about this, is that in section 6.5C, all the members were required to devote their time and attention to the LLC as is reasonably necessary and advisable. I think that's an objective determination in fact that shows that it was expected that everybody would be engaged in the operations of this, whether they did it or not. And there's a lot of cases to say if they could have done it, and here they had a requirement to do it, but didn't take that action, then that's dispositive. The other thing that a lot of the cases talk about is the books and records, that when parties have access to books and records of the LLC, that that is an indication that it's not something that's covered by a...
Well, I read that, well, a little different.
Okay.
And it was really going in the other direction. Even if somebody had the opportunity, had enough voting power to control, but didn't have expertise, didn't have access to the records, then they could still be considered investors in an investment contract. So it's when you have the majority control, but you don't have expertise or you don't have access to records, then it can still be an investment contract. Not that the fact that you have access to records makes it, precludes it being an investment contract when you otherwise don't have control. Am I misreading the cases?
I see my time is up. May I respond to that? I think it's just another factor that the courts say to look at, that when you look at all these things of things that they could do and had access to, I think it's important whether they did or did not have access. And in this case, they did have access. And they both testified in their depositions that there was no information that they ever requested prior to the closing that Paul Robin refused to provide them. So I just think this is a case that we're probably going to have to slug it out in a different form. I just don't think it's a federal case.
All right. We extended a little extra time to your counsel here. And so even though he thought he was going to get the last word on you, could we take, if you have, as Judge Anderson used to say, if you have a parting thought so you don't feel that you left with something you had to say.
And I'm at the risk of being funny and not being very funny. It's like the man at the guillotine. Do you have any last words? Now, I've got to have the last words. Simply put, I think we established on the factual record a Williamson Factor 3 totality of the circumstances that, based on Paul Robbins' admissions and his testimony, he agreed no one would have put a dime into this project but for him leading them to expect they would make a profit based on his efforts buying the lots and managing the 9.1 acres.
Okay. Do you concede that all the claims of fraud related to conduct preceding the conduct of the LLC?
Agreed, Judge okay. Hartz. Our only complaint was he hid the facts to us before we put our money okay. in, and that it was doomed from the get-go, not any post execution of the agreements.
Well, if you hadn't discovered the facts before, I'm not sure that your answer is correct. But we'll read the briefs and we'll decide how to decide the case. Thank you very much, Counselor. Excuse. The case is submitted.